coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
There is no evidence that adding talk therapy to ketamine enhances the outcome in any way. There are many people who believe that, some of them very passionately. Some of them believe it so strongly they condemn those who choose a different approach. I would be very happy to adopt their approach when there is evidence that it actually is an enhancer. Now, I don't mean it isn't an enhancer, but 83% without a formal CAP program is pretty good if you really want to see suffering lifted. You can't take two highly credentialed people and put them in a room with 3 hours for a patient and clone that or scale that up in any way. Depression is the leading cause of disability in the world. It's the leading cause of disability in the United States. It's running around 16 or 17% of the adult population. 4% of those kill themselves every year, literally. Ketamine prevents this suicide without any talk therapy. It's a crime to talk against ketamine because it isn't being done your way.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. A hot topic in the world of psychedelic medicine is whether ketamine infusion therapy is as effective as ketamine-assisted talk therapy, which is also called CAP. Today's guests, Dr. Steven Mandel and his son Sam Mandel, have administered over 13,000 treatments at their Los Angeles-based clinic, and they are passionate about the power of their intravenous ketamine treatment. On the show, we discuss the efficacy of IV ketamine therapy and how it compares to intramuscular as a route of administration. We talk about Dr. Mandel's specific protocol, including the use of a pump instead of a drip bag for administration. We cover the potential health concerns around ketamine and finish, as usual, with advice to psychedelic therapists. Dr. Steven Mandel has more than 40 years of experience utilizing ketamine as a board-certified anesthesiologist and has a master's degree in psychology. He is the co-founder and president of Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles and the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, Psychotherapists, and Practitioners, who are having their annual gathering November in Detroit. Sam Mandel is co-founder and chief operating officer of Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles. A mental health advocate and entrepreneur, he oversees all non-clinical functions of the company and has been active in the ketamine infusion therapy community since its formative days. He is also an actor and continues to pursue his passion in acting. Together, they've administered more than 13,000 ketamine infusions to treat mental health disorders, including depression, suicidality, anxiety, and PTSD, as well as chronic pain. And now, here is Dr. Steven Mandel and Sam Mandel. Dr. Steven Mandel, Sam Mandel, such a pleasure to have you on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. This is the first time that we've had a father-son duo on the show. And so, yeah, it's an honor to have you here. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Eamon.
So Dr. Mandel, I understand that you founded the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, as well as the Ketamine Clinics of Los Angeles. Now, did you and Sam co-found both of those organizations together? How did they begin?
Basically, we were at the Cairo conference in 2016, and I proposed that we have an organization with more frequent meetings of practitioners. And no one was very interested except about seven other people. So we all got together by phone, and in early 2017, we founded the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, which has now changed its name to the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, Psychotherapists, and Practitioners. And in fact, I was their first president, and I'm still on the board. But in 2014, way before this was even a twinkle in Dad's eye, We we founded Ketamine Clinics of Los Angeles. And Sam is an actor and was, I don't know if you know this, but it's not unusual for actors to be out of work. And he needed a side gig and he was doing restaurant work. And I know a lot about medicine and I'm fascinated by this stuff, but I don't know squat about business. And Sam said, look, I know a little about this stuff. Let me help you. And we were working out of a room about 8.5 by 8.5 feet, literally, in a plastic surgeon's office. I was the chief anesthesiologist. And in exchange for staying until the last patient left, I got to do what I wanted with the recovery room in the afternoons. I had gone to graduate school in clinical psychology. I loved clinical psychology. I ended up going to medical school and doing anesthesia, but I continued to be very interested in clinical psychology, particularly in mood disorders, both because of intellectual interest and personal interest. I have depression and suicidality in my family. I was very interested. When ketamine came out, I used ketamine for decades as an anesthetic. It was the most widely used anesthetic in the world. It was approved by the FDA as an anesthetic for humans in 1970. And it's been around. In fact, for about two decades, it was the most widely used anesthetic in the world. Billions, literally, with a B, ketamine anesthetics were given. So we know so much about this agent. And it really separates it from all the other fascinating synthetics and botanicals. The botanicals have been around for a very long time, but not really well studied. The synthetics are Johnny-come-latelys, and I love them, but they've been interdicted since 73 with Nixon's war on drugs. We don't know squat about those drugs. We think we know, but we really haven't had a lot of data.
Before we get too far into the distinctions there, just as far as the genesis of the practice, yes, I am passionate as an actor and a creative filmmaker, but I'm also very passionate about mental health and have always been a little entrepreneurial. And I too have, obviously, as my father said, you know, experience with friends and family struggling with addiction, with suicide, have had my own struggles over the years. And from volunteering with Teen Line, which was a teen-to-teen suicide prevention hotline when I was 13, had some early exposure to at least semi-formal work or training in mental health. And I think just over the years, through my own journey, I have always been very interested in mental health and as a kind of patient advocate in general and had a lot of strong views about our healthcare system. So it was a really amazing opportunity when Dr. Mandel was discussing this new treatment, and I started looking into it, you know, ketamine infusion therapy, and reading some of the clinical research, and every study was consistently showing very, very remarkably good results with really no negative results. There were naysayers out there, and there still are today, but there wasn't any real evidence-based issues with the treatment. And that was very, very interesting to me. And I've always been interested in more innovative and progressive approaches to problems in general, and especially within healthcare. And we really did start out in this tiny little room where I had to turn around and ask if he could please scoot his chair out so I could scoot my chair out so I could get up to go to the restroom. Like, no kidding. And, you know, just outside of the door was this recovery room where we saw patients. And I have really overseen the day-to-day and business operations of the practice. And Dr. Mandel has really pioneered the medical approach. And there are really a lot of things that he has brought to the treatment that is really, really interesting personalized approaches to this care.
I know you're volunteering with Teen Line, Sam, and other work in the nonprofit sector around mental health. This has been a real interest of yours. Have you yourself received a ketamine infusion treatment?
You know, that's a very good question. And I'll tell you honestly, I have, yes. It's not something that I talk about a lot, but I have. Yeah.
This is a big issue in the psychedelic world. Should people be administering these medicines if they haven't themselves experienced it? And it maybe it's just a personal bias, a personal instinct, but I always feel a bit more comfortable knowing that the people involved have had the experience. And so whether they're in the role of administering physician or they're in the role of all of the different operational aspects to bring this all together, it's really helpful for me as a potential patient patient to know that the people who are supporting me have been in my shoes and have, so that when I'm in that sort of like aftercare state just afterwards, when I'm in recovery, I'm like, oh, okay, these folks know the way that I feel. And so, yeah, it's just encouraging. And I appreciate both that you've had that experience and that you're willing to speak about it.
Yeah, you know, it's such a complex issue and it's such a big topic of conversation within the community. And I think that empathy and compassion can go a really long way. And people really can put themselves in your position, even if they haven't necessarily had an IV infusion of ketamine. There's definitely maybe other experiences that they've had in or outside of a clinical setting where they can really relate to what you're going through. You know, I had one for treatment for something that I was going through, and it wasn't really a curiosity as much as it was something that I relied on as support. I think that it's a little bit of a slippery slope with ethics and not wanting just anyone and everyone to think they should just go have an infusion, though I frankly think just about anyone could benefit from one, even if they haven't been clinically diagnosed. It's such a new, rapidly growing field, and it was the you know, substance itself and psychedelics in general have been demonized for so long. We've making progress like we haven't made in literally 50 years. And I'm a little protective and a little sensitive to making sure that we're keeping it really tight and all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed so that regulators don't try to start stepping on things in a way that's counterproductive. So yes, I think clinicians and even operators having had an experience can absolutely add a lot of value to their understanding of what their patients are going through. And also the question of, well, should everyone who's working in the space go and have one? I think it starts to get into a little bit of a slippery slope.
It also depends on whether you're coming from a seeker, shaman, healer, guide mode, or from a medical mode. In the medical mode, there's an illness and you treat it. You make a diagnosis. You don't do anything until you have a diagnosis and you treat that patient for that diagnosis. Those people, the tradition that's part of, looks very, very askance, very dimly and critically at the idea of the healer taking his own medicine or taking a medicine for a not indicated need, where you get into this a lot with practitioners who want to do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, and they want the experience. And many training programs include the experience. And lots of doctors anguish over, oh my, I'm giving them drugs and I don't have a diagnosis. And am I going to be in trouble? And am I ethical? And is this right? And even further pushing the envelope, there are many people who feel some of these substances, and they're all very, very similar and they're all different. But ketamine particularly and other substances, like ketamine, can we give them for performance enhancement? Is that like giving a baseball player some steroids? Is that cheating? Is that kind of selling drugs? What is that? And what's wrong with selling drugs anyway? I mean, do we want to only permit pharmaceutical houses to sell drugs? Or do we want to have other people who may be more compassionate and more empathic and more from the point of view of the buyer also selling drugs? Or is that just totally heretical? I mean, where's your head?
It's more than, you know, selling drugs, I think, when there's a model of an actual treatment, right? And actual being involved in the care of somebody and involving them in their own care. I mean, one of the things that people talk about with psychedelics is giving people their agency back, you know, really bringing them into their power to be a part of their own healing journey and to not just go and get fixed. I think our traditional model of medicine is you go to a doctor and you get fixed. You go to a surgeon, they do surgery, they fix you, you're done. You know, something is done to you. You go and you get a prescription, you take a pill, you know, you're fixed. And obviously that model has not worked very well for us when you look at the rates of depression and suicide and anxiety that have skyrocketed even before the pandemic. And then, of course, over the last year, upwards of 200-300%. So these ideas of going and getting fixed have not been serving us very well. And I think something that's unique and powerful about psychedelic medicine, and in particular ketamine, which is the only one that's legal in the US right now, is that people are, at least when they go to a good provider who's doing it the way that we feel it should be done, they're really participating in their own healing. when they're given an opportunity to tap into their power and perspectives in their life in a different way. And so I think that's really beautiful.
Even that is being attacked as too much like fixing, and that the patient needs to be in a talking therapy and the medicine administered as part of that therapy, which I think is not a reasonable thing.
Well, you are teeing up one of the big things I want to talk about today. But before we jump into this idea of talk therapy versus ketamine infusion therapy, let's just start with a little bit of the foundation of why is ketamine, to our best knowledge scientifically at this moment, why is it so effective for treatment-resistant depression? What is it about ketamine that impacts? Is it the serotonin 2A receptor? Is it the glutamate system? Like, what is it that is actually happening to the brain that is making this such a powerful tool?
Eamon, so many things are happening in the brain and to the brain and in humans to the mind, which is far more than just the brain. We know only a handful of those things. We know that glutamate receptors are stimulated. We know that AMPA is stimulated. We know that the default mode network is put at rest. We know that, at least in small mammals, certain areas of the brain actually involute with depression. And you can cause this. And if you give these subjects ketamine, those areas actually grow. And receptor density and dendrite connections increase. And this is not an opinion. You can see it. And if you then subject those subjects to depressive circumstances, those same areas involute. And if you give them ketamine again, they grow back. It's just mind-boggling. What this all means is we really don't know. We know a lot of stuff is happening when we give ketamine, and it's happening remarkably quickly and in a very high percentage of patients and very safely. And we know that it works. But if we had to tell you why it works, not so clear.
But definitely some of the things that you're mentioning, Dr. Mandel, we do know. And while there's still a huge amount left to be understood, and even what we think we know, maybe we don't even really fully know, but we have a sense of some of those things, right? And as an NMDA receptor antagonist and causing an increase in the neurotransmitter glutamate, you know, these are unique processes that ketamine causes that traditional antidepressants don't. We know that. So we know this is really getting at mental health, mood disorders in a different, you know, mechanism of action than we've traditionally approached it. So one of the explanations is, why is it so effective? Go figure, we're trying something different, right? Definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Well, that's kind of what we've done with these copycat SSRIs, SNRIs, atypical antipsychotics. We keep coming out with these drugs with a pretty new color and a pretty new name, and it does essentially more or less the same thing, right? And so there's the neurochemical differences that and impacts, I should say, that ketamine is having. And then there's also the psychological component, the experiential, which is a completely separate thing that's also very unique to ketamine.
I didn't intend it to be glib at all, but we don't know why ketamine does what it does. We're learning some of the mechanisms. Everything I've said and everything Sam said is right, and we pretty well covered the current understanding. I don't know that I mentioned that it works through the glutamatergic system and all the other things that we know about work through the serotonin or norepinephrine system, a few through the dopamine. But that it's not accurate to say, because we know these things are associated with the changes ketamine produces, that we understand how ketamine works.
Well, and Sam, you just mentioned the experience and, you know, there's what's going on in the brain neurochemically, and then there's also the experience of the participant in the therapy, what they're actually seeing, how they're able to think about things that might have been unavailable to them in a non-altered state of consciousness, things they might have been afraid to touch, traumas that might be too painful, that when you're in a dissociated state, you may actually be able to consider these in ways that you wouldn't be able to with like post-traumatic stress symptoms flaring up. So there's, in addition to the neurochemistry, there's the actual experience is extraordinarily potent too.
Incredibly so, incredibly so. And what we find is that they both have a huge impact, and there can be tremendous benefit for patients without necessarily as profound of an experiential component because of the neurochemical impact on the brain, that there is measurable healing, growth, increased brain function and activity that actually helps even without some of the other aspects of the experience. But together, they are exponentially more effective. And there's not necessarily evidence to support that as far as I know. But, you know, we've done this for 7 years. We've done over 13,000 infusions. We've been full time. You know, one of the things that set us apart in the beginning is Monday through Friday, 9 to 7. This is all that we do all day, every day. We have really not focused on very many other modalities and have dedicated ourselves to this. So in that, there's an enormous amount of nuance. And I think, you know, people look at it and they go, oh, you just start an IV, you run some ketamine, boom, there's an infusion, no big deal. Well, there's a lot that's going on there. But to your point about trauma, I mean, just one example, I mean, there's a patient that always sticks out very vividly in my mind because I thought it was so profound. And this was a while back, but he had a trauma that he had suppressed so deeply, he literally did not remember it or even realize that it had occurred. And after his infusion, he recovered from it and sat up and said, oh my God. And he shared about this horrible trauma. And he said, I just realized. And it just was like a missing piece that made so much sense in his life. And people are able to navigate these things, not only realize things that they have suppressed so deeply, but also have a kind of objective perspective on them and work through them and reflect. And the experience can be so vast, from meditative to spiritual to reflective. And one infusion can be very, very different from the next. So there's a whole world there of the experiential side that can be very, very healing for people.
Well, and so this, we're starting to come up against this question that is really at the core of what I wanted to talk to you both about today. So in preparing for this interview, I was aware, Dr. Mandel, that you promote ketamine infusion without talk therapy. And with a lot of the folks I've talked to, it's almost been a kind of religious piece of faith that it's not psychedelic therapy, it's psychedelic assisted therapy, and that the actual therapeutic component, the talk therapy component, is fundamental to the experience. And I don't know that there's evidence yet or research that specifically says that that's true, but it seems to be absolute orthodoxy, particularly in what I refer to as the more sort of like cultural legacy wing of the psychedelic community. So the question is, why do you feel that the infusion approach is just as, or perhaps more efficacious than the talk therapy approach?
Well, first, let's start out with a few basics. I love talk therapy. I think talk therapy is extremely valuable without ketamine, and more so with ketamine. And it's a mischaracterization to say that I don't think talk therapy is valuable or important or sometimes necessary. It isn't always necessary. There's tremendous empirical evidence that ketamine helps people with depression, with suicidality, with PTSD. In the literature, it's about 71%. In our clinic, it's 83%. That's because we pioneered some techniques of the nuances of administration. Now, 83% is a lot more than 71. And we reliably get 83%. There are other clinics doing better than 71 as well, some of them because they're using techniques which we freely share. We want everyone to do as good a job as we do. And we're very eager for anyone who can to teach us how to do an even better job. 83% is fabulous. It still leaves 17% suffering. Second, there is no evidence that adding talk therapy to ketamine enhances the outcome in any way. There are many people who believe that, some of them very passionately. Some of them believe it so strongly they condemn those who choose a different approach. I would be very happy to adopt their approach when there is evidence that it actually is an enhancer. Now, I don't mean it isn't an enhancer, but 83% without a formal CAP program is pretty good. Now, if I have a patient and I infuse that patient and send them off to their therapist that afternoon with lozenges, or another, the next afternoon with lozenges that I've prescribed, and I've told the practitioner, the therapist, how to integrate into his session or her session with the patient, am I giving ketamine-assisted psychotherapy? The doctrinaire people would say, oh, no, it has to be a dyad in the session. Well, that's complete BS. There is no evidence for that. It's charming, and I love it, and I have a lot of regard for those who do it. But to say it's the only right way, it's just nonsense. It's very self-defeating if you really want to see suffering lifted. You can't take two highly credentialed people and put them in a room with 3 hours for a patient and clone that or scale that up in any way. Depression is the leading cause of disability in the world. It's the leading cause of disability in the United States. It's running around 16 or 17% of the adult population. 4% of those kill themselves every year, literally. Ketamine prevents this suicide without any talk therapy. It's a crime to talk against ketamine because it isn't being done your way.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful words right there. And I agree with all of it. You know, this is such a complicated issue, or I guess it's really not. People make it into a complicated issue. There's a lot of people who are really, really, it makes me sad that there's so much energy in the space right now where there's these kind of factions breaking off and people doing battle with one another about who's right and who's better. And I think that, frankly, there's a lot of ego involved. And, you know, our position is and has always been that they're both valuable and that they're just different. And it really depends on the needs of the patient. And some patients might be better suited for one versus the other, but pretty much everyone can benefit from both. And if they have the opportunity to do one and not the other, they absolutely should do it. There is, you know, just to reiterate what Dr. Mandel said, there is zero evidence to support that talk therapy, or excuse me, that CAP is more effective. And we advocate for talk therapy before and after sessions. And someone can, you know, a lot of things come up during an infusion that they can, a patient can take that information or that experience to their therapist and work through it and have big breakthroughs. It doesn't necessarily have to fit into a super specific kind of limited model. I think some of the practitioners who are against infusions are that way because they're not either able or willing to provide infusions. And they want to have more kind of control over the space or what's being done in the space. But it's sad because there's no shortage of suffering, as Dr. Mandel was saying. And really, the kind of pioneers in the field should be coming together to make this as widely available as possible to everyone with the highest standards of ethics, and to make sure that patients come first, and to not let the money that's coming into this space make this into a business opportunity that oversteps patients' needs, and to not allow practitioners who are well-meaning but not well-informed to do harm, and to not allow those who might not be so well-meaning and who are looking at this as a money grab to do harm. And instead, a lot of energy is being expelled on, I'm right, no, I'm right, no, I'm right. And actually, I think everyone's right. And it's, you know, the evidence here to support ketamine for depression, 80, 85%, maybe even 90% of all of the legitimate clinical research, double-blind, placebo-controlled, crossover studies, leading institutions, you name it, USC, UCLA, Stanford, Harvard, National Institute of Mental Health, Yale, the list goes on and on and on. They are almost exclusively done IV infusions of ketamine. And it's been almost exclusively a half a milligram of ketamine per kilogram of body weight over 40 minutes. These are the standards that have consistently been recreated to confirm ketamine as a highly effective antidepressant. And there's been almost no CAP in any of that. So for people to come out and say that we're doing harm or wrong or shouldn't be doing infusions or it's not real healing is really absurd.
Furthermore, virtually all of those CAP practitioners are giving IM ketamine. And when you ask why they're not doing IV, they have an awful lot of reasons. But they end up saying, well, it's just the same thing, basically. Well, it isn't the same thing at all. Route of administration is profoundly important because episodic routes of administration, such as IM, can't possibly maintain the consistent blood level that an IV infusion given via a pump works for.
Okay, so yeah, that's an important clarification. And when you say IM, you mean intramuscular. And so we have ketamine lozenges, we have intramuscular ketamine, we have the IV infusion, and then of course, as I think everyone knows, you can go to a club and put it in your nose, right? So that's kind of the lowest value, I'm guessing, of ketamine.
You can go to the doctor and put it in your nose.
I was just
going to
say, yeah, now thanks to, you know, Johnson & Johnson, you have Spravato or S-ketamine, and you know, you can go to the doctor and put it in your nose if you want.
Oh, yeah, they have the spray bottle.
Yeah, nasal spray. So the lozenges would be sublingual if we're kind of breaking down the ROAs or the routes of administration, right? So you have the IM intramuscular, IV intravenous. You have the lozenge or the troche, which dissolves under the tongue. You know, that would be sublingual. You have oral ketamine. Some people are swallowing it in the form of a pill or something else. There's even suppositories, patches, you know, topical. So really just about every way you can imagine, there's people out there using ketamine in that way. And in insufflation nasally as well. When it comes to ROA, IV is the gold standard. It is unique in many, many ways. And I'd love to talk more about that. And I know Dr. Mandel has a lot to say about that. But to just say, well, they're all the same or it doesn't really matter is just not, it's just factually inaccurate.
So, okay, I'd like to learn more about the efficacy of the IV. And I'd love to hear it about this couched within your protocol specifically. A little while ago, you alluded to the fact that there's aspects of your protocol that bumped that 71% up to an 83%. So I'm wondering if you could describe your protocol and perhaps you can kind of weave in why the IV is so valuable in the context of the specific protocol that you're using.
Okay, I don't know where to start. Intravenous ketamine is compared to intramuscular ketamine by saying, well, the bioavailability of intramuscular is just about as high as IV. IV is 100%. IM is usually more than 95%. But IM is episodic. You give a shot, and you get an enormous rise. Picture a rocket going up. And the rocket goes up until its fuel is burnt out, and then it falls down. And that's somewhat how the graph of blood levels with IM ketamine gives. You give an IM injection, starting at zero time, and you get an enormous upstroke, and then a not that gradual downstroke. As it goes down, it gets more and more and more gradual. And if you want to maintain a consistent level, you can't do it. Practitioners who do want to maintain a consistent level give a second shot. 11 to 14 minutes afterward is the typical standard, if there is a standard in that part of the business. Absent a second shot, you get a huge upstroke way into the stratosphere where the patient is way too altered by the medication to really deal effectively in any kind of dialogue. And that concentration falls off, and the patient then is less and less altered and can interact with the therapist, the healer, the shaman, the partner, whatever it is. And then the level falls to a level below that, at which time it's kind of over, unless you give a second shot or give a second shot in anticipation of that fall. On the other hand, with an intravenous infusion, you can take off as rapidly as you like. You can make it rocket ship-like, or you can make it more like an airplane. And you get to the altitude, the degree of uptundation, the degree of alteration, the degree of being out there that you want and the patient wants, And you can stay at that level for minutes or hours or even days. And if anything is a problem, you can turn it off and it's gone very quickly, much more quickly than I am. And if you need more, you can crank it up. And if you're using pumps, which we pioneered syringe pumps for the administration of ketamine, it used to be given in an IV bag. They'd squirt some ketamine into a bag of saline or lactated ringers and drip it with a control knob and with regular size tubing. And changing blood levels takes a while with that setup. If you use a syringe pump and small bore tubing, you can change the blood level in much less time than it's taken me to describe this. It's just remarkable. You can dial it up and you can dial it down.
It provides tremendous precision. It's a digital pump, and there's, I mean, you can make it exact, and the continuity of care and the consistency also from one infusion to the next is unmatched in any other method. Even with an IV bag, you can only be so precise. There's some margins there. I am as well. I just wanted to add, I mean, it also, you know, it's like if you've ever put too much salt in your soup or something, once you've added it, you can't take it out. This is a really important thing that Dr. Mandel just mentioned as well. You know, once the ketamine's in, it's gone. Somebody could have a terrible reaction. They could be very frightened. They could be having an issue, a medical issue, which ketamine is very, very safe, but it can happen, especially if someone gets too much and or they have other medical underlying, you know, conditions. And you're just kind of stuck. You got to deal with the situation as best you can. With IV, turning off the pump, people do come back or calm down very, very quickly in the event of any kind of an adverse reaction. Also, there's a huge amount of variability in the absorption rate with IM. So you're squirting this into muscle and, you know, depending on where and how and the person and BMI and all these other factors, you know, their body mass index. I mean, you could have somebody could have it be absorbed incredibly rapidly or much, much more slowly. So there's so many variables and unknowns that are really outside of your control. When you're using an IV, you have maximum control over all of those variables.
With the IM, you're putting in, you're depositing medicine in a muscle, as has just been described. And your whole tradition is first, do no harm. And you can't take it back. So there's a terrible, very damaging tendency to underdose with IM. And then you either are stuck with too little or you give a second injection. And how do you calculate how much more to give to get what you want? Because the kinetics of it get really complicated, much more than we can really do comfortably without levels. So how much... what percentage of the first shot at what interval do you give? It's like trying to scratch your shoulder with your big toe. You can probably get into condition to do that. Or you can just use your hand. Come on.
Well, also the people who do, you know, one last thing just really quickly is, you know, the people who are doing IM, who are very, you know, very adamant about it and who are adamant about this idea of doing a series will also say, yeah, well, we won't just do a second shot. Then we'll do a third or maybe even a fourth. And
why not do it continuously?
You know, and it's the same thing. And we'll just, this is a workaround that achieves the same result. It's just not, it's scientifically not real to talk about it or think about it in that way.
Let's talk a little bit more about the protocol itself. Now, you mentioned that you're using this digital pump, which is giving you this consistent, you know, flying altitude. What are some of the other things that you've pioneered that other centers have perhaps adopted in, I mean, you've done over 13,000 infusions, so that's a lot of opportunity to iterate on the very best way of doing it. What are some of the other aspects of your particular protocol that you found most helpful?
The pump and the small bore tubing and giving the dose by the minute, not by a predetermined amount. We're going to give half a milligram per kilogram over 40 minutes. That doesn't work. If you calculate that out, that's a certain amount of micrograms per kilogram per minute. If you're giving it in micrograms per kilogram per minute, then you realize there's an opportunity to change that each minute. So what we did at first was we weren't getting as good a results as we wanted. We were getting about 68 to 71%. And I said to myself, what's sacred about half a milligram per kilogram over 40 minutes. And I looked into how it was evolved, and I said, there's nothing sacred about it at all. So we went to 55 minutes, which just doesn't sound like much more than 40. Percentage-wise, it's a big chunk. And we realized because we were giving increments by the minute, we could change. We could start out with 0.5 to be, we want to start low and go slow, but we can give more. And we found that actually it's very variable with the individual and with their experience with the medicine. Increasing the micrograms, which if you do all the arithmetic, it calculates out to 12.5 micrograms per kilogram per minute. So we start our patients at 14 micrograms per kilogram per minute. We give a loading dose, which is like the rocket ship in IM. It gets a bolus, a push in the IV, which is just like their push in the muscle. We then follow that out with a infusion, a drip, what used to be called a drip, an infusion of 14 mics per kilo per minute. We found that got much better results, and the 55 minutes got much better results. We reported them widely. Some people adopted them and said, thanks. A lot of people said, that's interesting, and kept on doing what they were doing. The other thing we found serendipitously was there's a bodily reaction called nystagmus, horizontal coarse nystagmus. It's a jerky motion of the eyes, a horizontal jerky motion. Vertical jerky motions usually mean some kind of neurologic derangement and should be looked into and have nothing to do with this conversation. Horizontal coarse jerky motions are an indication of the sweet spot. Just as if you give too little ketamine, you don't get an optimum result. If you give too much, you don't get an optimum result. Obviously, the original reports in this area were people had ketamine as an anesthetic, and they had gobs of this stuff, and they still got some of them a really good benefit in relief of their PTSD. But it turns out if the executive function, if the ego is intact, you can do much more with the journey than if you come back and say, gee, what the hell happened? So you want to get to coarse horizontal nystagmus and stay there. Because if you go beyond there, if you just keep dosing, well, if a little is good, more is better, they may have a really fascinating trip, but they won't be able to remember it. They won't be able to integrate it into therapy. They won't know what's happened.
So the way that you judge whether the participant is having the optimal experience is by monitoring the eye movement. You're talking about you're monitoring minute by minute the amount of ketamine that's going in the bloodstream. How are you monitoring if it's a subjective experience for the patient or participant? How do you know what's optimal there?
We come into the room. We ask them how they're doing and if they're feeling the medicine. Some other questions we ask them, they give us a very precise assessment of where they are in space. And we also say, I'm going to lift your eye shield because we offer eye shields and most people do use them. They're optional, but most people do use them. Would you look at me, please? And you say, tch. And you know you've got horizontal nystagmus. Or you see just a tiny bit. And you say, and they tell you their story. And you say, would you like to try a little more medicine? And most of the time they say yes, and you crank them up and you come back 6 or 7 minutes later. We actually time this, and now they're coarse. Now, if you decide, well, let's see if a little was good, more is better, we go up a little more, the nystagmus tends to be attenuated. You don't want to do that. You want to leave it where it's coarse.
Yeah, I think I want to point out this is an important finding, but I don't know if Dr. Mano made clear it's not the end all be all when it comes to assessing a patient. And just like you can go too far and go past it and have missed it, and then you think, oh, well, we'll just add more and more until we see it. You may have already gone too far. And also, it doesn't happen with every patient every time that they are in the quote sweet spot. So it's a great discovery and it's a great guiding principle, but it's definitely not a hard rule. There is a sweet spot. And one of the things that I point out is this is where I think a little bit of the art comes into meet the science and a little bit of the judgment and some of the nuance of having done this so often and so much really adds a lot of value. It's really hard to fully express all the ways that we actually would assess, or I should say that our medical team assesses the patient, including Dr. Mandel and the other medical staff in our clinic, because there is a level of judgment that is more learned from experience than can be taught. And that's, you know, assessing the patient, wanting them to be present enough to know, you know, who they are and where they are, but also far enough away from who they are on the day to day that they can be having this separate objective kind of experience of themselves and of their life and their situation. It is a balance, and not enough is not good, and too much is not good.
So you're talking about assessing patients, and you have an entire medical team that does that. You've given me a figure of 71%. Your clinic is doing 83%. What does that mean when you say that it's 83% effective? How do you know that it is effective? How are you monitoring these patients, these clients over time and assessing the efficacy of this? I understand that ketamine can have enormous impacts, particularly with treatment-resistant depression, but that those impacts kind of fade over time. So can you tell me how you're assessing the entire patient journey? Because 13,000 infusions, that means you're getting a lot of data potentially on how effective this is. So how are you assessing the long-term and indeed the kind of medium-term effectiveness of this treatment?
It's a really important question. And the detractors of ketamine say, yes, maybe it works, but it goes away real quick. That is not true. Ketamine infusions properly given give most patients about 3 months, about 12 weeks, before they need a booster. So we assess their relief from their symptoms using standard paper and pencil tests that are well known in the behavioral field, in psychology and psychiatry. We use the MADRS, we use the Beck, we use the PHQ-9. We also use something that's relatively new, but turns out to be very valuable. We do something called Mood Monitor, recently acquired by Osmind. Mood Monitor is the brainchild of a couple of people, one of whom was a patient who needed to know when it was time for his next booster. And what this does is it sends people a text at a time every day, at a time of their choosing. And they choose a number from 1 to 10 as to how they're doing, 1 being, I'm really in the toilet today, and 10 being, I just feel fabulous. And it's not intuitive that people would be able to come up with a number, but just like with pain scales, it turns out that people can reliably really nail just what level they are. You know, I'm kind of a 6.5 today. I'll pick 7 or I'll pick 6, but they really know. And the fact that they can text back every day and we can graph that 1 day, 2 days, so what's the big deal? Graphing that over time is profoundly impactful for the patient, for the patient's therapist, because we do love therapy, despite what people say, and for the patient's infusionist, too, because the patient doesn't wait until he crashes or she crashes before they seek boosters. Yeah, they know when they're starting to dwindle, and they call, and they make time to come in.
Yeah, and Dr. Mandel says, you know, the good old-fashioned, you know, pencil and paper, but we're a pretty tech-forward practice. So while those are, I know he's speaking just kind of in you know, descriptive language of that, but we are very tech-forward. So, you know, we do use text messaging, you know, HIPAA-compliant, you know, secure and encrypted text messaging. We use a lot of tools and assessments that are done digitally to be very convenient for the patient, where we do collect a lot of data, and we're not really a research center, but we are very data driven. And we really do like to look at these objective measures for patients before, during, and after their treatment. And we follow people long term. We don't really just, you know, treat them and then we're done. We have patients we haven't seen in, you know, literally several years who we still have engaging with us as far as keeping us up to date on how they're doing, touching base, checking in. Some of them, you know, doing quite well. I mean, we've had some patients who've gone over 2 years after an initial series of infusions without needing any boosters or follow-up care. We see on average about 3 months of relief, but and some people much, you know, get a shorter duration of relief and others longer. But some, and it's unusual, but some have gone as long as 2 years or longer. So, you know, our initial series is 6 infusions over anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks. More typically 2 to 3 weeks, but people do often come back for follow-up treatment on an as-needed basis. And, you know, that's another thing that we do is we really do make it as needed, and we don't prescribe a one-size-fits-all model. I think that's another thing that really kind of sets us apart from a lot of the research and a lot of other clinics is we really do individualized treatment. So we're not stuck with a protocol where everyone has to get the exact same thing because those are the rules and this is the red tape and or we're doing a study and we have to have a consistent variables here. We're a treatment center. So we get to modify. And when I say we, really Dr. Mandel and the medical team get to modify protocols to best fit the needs of each individual. And that includes during their course of their treatment and then also, you know, our follow-up, our aftercare, and whether or not they come back and how frequently and what that looks like. You know, there are some clinics oftentimes because it's good for business, will prescribe everyone to come back on a set schedule. Come and see me again for two in a month and then two every month and then one every month and, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's a great way to continue to generate revenue. Not everyone needs that. Some of them might argue, well, I'm just trying to help the patient to stay ahead of their depression. Well, sure, but you're ending up with a lot of people spending a lot more time and money than they really needed to. And if you actually use tools to measure how they're doing and you called and emailed and checked in with them and actually asked how they were doing and spoke with their other providers, maybe you wouldn't be providing more medicine than necessary and you'd be staying ahead of the depression still.
But you asked, what's success? And I started to mention the paper and pencil tests, all of which are given digitally, by the way. So we say we have a success if the scores on those battery of tests are better by 50% or more, and that is persistent for 12 weeks or more. So if they don't get relief that measures at more than 50%, and if they don't get relief that's sustained for 12 weeks or more, they're not successes. It's a very rigorous, very high standard of what constitutes success. It's not, I feel better next day.
Yeah, and we do, you know, advocate for a lot in addition to talk therapy as far as an aftercare program. And we provide a guide to patients and we really do check in and follow up with them regularly long term. And there's no real set limit on that. There's no extra charge for that. We don't say, oh, well, hey, you know, you kind of paid us for the infusions. If you want to keep calling us, you got to give us some money or something like that. We are available to our patients. It's one of the reasons why we have a full-time team of 10, because to provide this level of care, it takes a lot of people. It takes a village, you know, and we really do provide personalized care. You know, even me, it astounds me. I go to very good doctors when I call and I can't get through to someone or I can't even get a call back or an email responded to. You know, and these are some of the top doctors in LA. It's really, really irritating. You know, we really pride ourselves on picking up the phone when it rings the first time, responding to the email within hours and being really, really available to our patients. But we advocate for a lot of lifestyle changes like a healthy diet and adequate sleep and exercise and talk therapy and, you know, looking at other potentially negative patterns or habits, whether it's substance abuse or other negative relationships that might be contributing to the underlying symptoms. So we really try to be guiding patients to look more, I guess, holistically at why they're dealing with what they're dealing with as well. And we work very collaboratively with other providers. So whether they're seeing a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist or whoever else that they're working with, we really like to exchange and share information for the patient's benefit when we have their authorization to do so.
There is so much that I want to talk about, and we're coming close to our time today. One thing I want to bring up, and perhaps you can respond to this briefly, there's a couple of issues with ketamine that came out more when it was a popular party drug, you know, Special K, for example. And the three issues that come up are addiction, issues with ketamine breaking down in a way that damages the bladder and kidneys, and finally, whether ketamine, too much ketamine abuse can negatively affect cognition, can negatively affect memory. And these are three things that have sort of anecdotally been in kind of the space of psychedelics, particularly in kind of a party space. And I'm curious, in your work with ketamine, what your understanding is of any negative impacts that ketamine might have on a particular individual.
Ketamine is not addictive. That's your first question. There is no physiologic attachment. There's no development of cravings. People make bad decisions about substances. They do that about alcohol. They do that about tobacco. Those are both addictive. They also do it about ice cream and about chocolate. And some of them do it about ketamine. Now, if you think that someone can have a chocolate addiction or an ice cream addiction, they can have a ketamine addiction. But if you think it has to be like an opiate or like something with nicotine in it, there's no such thing. That's question one. Question two, does ketamine damage the bladder? Ketamine is used by three different communities, at least. The anesthesia community, the recreation community, largely made up, honestly, of people who are self-medicating because they're suffering, and the therapeutic community interested in treating depression and suicidality and PTSD. Those three communities use different routes of administration and methods of administration, and they use totally different dosage ranges. In the community that uses ketamine, quote, recreationally, among those who use it for years at over a gram a day, now this is all anecdotal because people don't come forward and tell us about this because we put them in jail for it, which is totally stupid, doesn't help them or us. Ketamine given in high doses chronically for long periods produces bladder damage in between 15 and 20% of those who do it. And the bladder damage is distinct from other kinds of cystitises, and it doesn't respond to the same kinds of treatment. And if people persist in taking ketamine beyond the early signs, they can really do very bad damage to their bladder and their ureters and their kidneys. So ketamine bladder is a real thing. It's virtually never seen in clinical practice. It's fairly regularly seen in communities of abuse. Abuse is not the right word, but that you know what I'm saying. The third thing you want to talk about is cognitive deficit. And we see cognitive deficit sometimes in animals given massive doses. And we see cognitive deficit in the communities of overuse. But very randomly, inconsistently, all of those people take adulterated ketamine. All of those people take almost virtually all those people take lots of other substances. There's no data, and I've looked for it, and I want to be shown wrong if I'm wrong, that there is any sign that therapeutic ketamine produces any cognitive deficit whatsoever, other than the short-term feeling addled immediately following the administration of the medicine. Those are the three questions.
Well, and I love that you answered them so briefly and emphatically. With a lot of psychedelics that are coming into therapeutic use, there's a lot of misinformation over many years about harm and a lot of confusion. And so it's really helpful to have more clarity about that. So I very much appreciate your response there. So I'd love to hear, just as a close, kind of where you see, so you together co-founded the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, which is now the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, Therapists and Practitioners.
Let me just correct that for the record. So Dr. Mandel and I co-founded, I'm the co-founder, COO, he's founder and president of Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles, which is our clinic. It's a private clinic, private practice in Culver City in Los Angeles. We have, you know, 10 full-time employees, and we're dedicated to ketamine there. That's our business together, and that's what we've been dedicated to for over 7 years now. The American Society of Ketamine Physicians, which is now also Psychotherapist Practitioners, ASKP3, is a nonprofit organization that's an international nonprofit that Dr. Mandel really spearheaded the founding of, and is a original founder, was the first president of, is still active on the board. And that is a totally separate kind of project. And I've been obviously supportive of him in that endeavor, but that's something that he went and did with other clinicians who all came together and said, we need to have a community where, you know, providers are speaking more openly and freely with one another. And now there's well over 300 members, annual conference every year, except for last year has always been in person. Another one coming up this year, somewhere in the United States. And it's mostly
November in Detroit. You got to be there. It's there the largest collection of practitioners in the world. And you'll meet the IM people and the CAP people and the IV people, although organizationally we are focused on IV, And you'll meet people who think you can't do it responsibly without therapy. And you meet people.
Think, all kinds of thoughts. Yeah.
You know, it's the therapy's the cherry on top and not suitable or necessary.
By the way, one thing we didn't say, and I know we're low on time here, but, you know, when it comes back just really quickly to the CAP conversation, I mean, you know, there are people who use ketamine intravenously for CAP or for KEP, ketamine enhanced psychotherapy, which is something we didn't even talk about. And that is really a new level of integrating psychotherapy with ketamine, in my opinion, because of all the reasons that we covered about the value of intravenous administration. And when you can add that and mix it with the therapy, which is very rarely done, usually because there's just logistical challenges that the practitioner is not, again, not able or willing to do it that way. It's more time intensive or cost intensive. That is really a kind of special, different thing in and of itself. But yes, conference has lots of different schools of thought. Pretty much every school of thought you could think of is going to be there. I just wanted to clarify the organizations and the distinctions between them.
Now, that's a wonderful clarification, and I very much appreciate you jumping in with that. What I was going to speak to is from the perspective of both the private clinic and the society, what are you most excited about? What are you most concerned about? What do you see on the horizon for this particular branch of medicine moving forward?
Huge question.
Yeah, that's your end of interview question.
Can I say more than one sentence?
No. We got some time.
Ketamine is very special. Ketamine is very special because we know what it can do and we know what it won't do. It's safe. It's reliable. It's been used billions of times over 50 years. The other synthetics have tremendous promise in relieving suffering. The botanicals also have tremendous promise. I cannot wait for them to become available. We need to go a little bit gradually to make sure that what we're doing doesn't harm anyone. What I'm excited about is their introduction and the decriminalization. You know, in California today, we have a bill coming up, very bravely submitted. State Senator Scott Weiner is sponsoring Assembly Bill 519 that will decriminalize these psychoactive substances. There has been so much lost because it's all having to be done in a closet or in an alley. And it's bad for the people who are using it, and it's bad for all of us who would like to have better tools to relieve suffering. So that's coming up. The use of these substances out of the criminal justice system would be a giant step. Depression is the leading cause of disability in this country. When are we going to take that seriously? When are we going to face the huge morbidity and mortality that it engenders, not solely in the sufferer, but in the sufferer's husband or wife, in the sufferer's children and parents and employer and church and PTA. This is a squandering of talent. We have 15, 16, 70% of our population unable to really realize their own potential. It not only deprives them, it deprives the community. When we start to take this seriously and we start to make insurance companies pay for this terribly disabling thing that we have tools for now, so that people don't have to reach deep into their pockets or borrow money to get relief, that will be a new day. And that day is dawning. It started with nasal insufflation, which, by the way, is great, except it only works about 40% of the time, which is unfortunate. It's lucky if you're one of that 40%. Now we have the Blue Cross in Massachusetts saying, it's IV is so much better and so much cheaper. We're going to start to reimburse for IV. But so far, they're confining it only to psychiatrists and only to patients who have failed 4 oral treatments first. But I think this is interim. I think very soon, all the people who treat with ketamine, the psychiatrists and the anesthesiologists and the emergency room physicians and the internists and the family docs, are going to be paid for the work that they do. And we're not going to stop siloing and calling doctors. They have to stay in their lane. Our lane is suffering. This is really important work. We shouldn't confine it to any one specialty.
Yeah. You know, we didn't even touch on the fact that ketamine for mood disorders is off-label, but ketamine's FDA approved and the treatment's off-label. And it's, you know, is it covered by insurance or not? And when and how frequently and how that's shifting? And that's really a whole other meaty conversation in and of itself as well. And the bill that Dr. Manel mentions with all the implications in criminal justice reform and people having the opportunity to get healing more on their own, but also some of the risks and concerns that that might bring, what that means for medical practices. And yet it's not, they can't integrate it yet, but people are going to be able to have it and be, you know, have it be essentially maybe a ticket or something. But what happens when somebody wants to start bringing something to their session and is it a licensed professional who isn't really allowed to be working with it? I mean, these are really, really meaty conversations. And I think, Eamon, you have so many great questions and we still have so much to say. I hope that maybe one day in the not so distant future, you'd have us back because I really enjoyed speaking with you. And there's a lot more to cover. If I may just also add with respect to your last question, I have a lot of concerns. I think I can say we have a lot of concerns with doing things right. And as the space is really exploding with a lot of interest from a lot of different people, whether it's private equity, venture capitalists, people looking to invest, people who want to be actively involved, clinicians and non-clinicians, publicly traded companies, people who are interested in ketamine and those who are just interested in psychedelics in general, a lot of people coming in from the cannabis space, there's a lot of activity. And, you know, our commitment always has been and always will be the patient. And we really feel what's best for the patient is best for us and best for the field. And not everybody shares that view. And so as things grow and expand so rapidly, we really don't want unneeded regulation to come in that's counterproductive, but we also don't want people doing harm to the reputation of the treatment or to patients. And, you know, I just read a horrible article recently, and I don't want to end on a down note, but of a couple who was working with MAPS, with MDMA assisted psychotherapy several years ago. And this article came out where a patient was sexually assaulted and sued. And, you know, this was settled outside of court and it was a married couple doing this session. And, you know, these substances are putting people in a very vulnerable state and the mindset that they're in and the setting that they're in are essential, set and setting, right? And really need for anyone who's entering this to be very, very sensitive to that. It's a super delicate issue. And, you know, I cringe every time there's even, you know, an allegation of a patient feeling uncomfortable or being, you know, assaulted or in any way in a practice. And, you know, there are some people out there who are not all well-meaning. So as the space grows and expands, I guess my hope is just that, you know, the patients can become more informed about what to look for and making sure that they're entering a safe environment. Because just as they can find a place to get exponential healing, they can find a place where they can really get a new trauma. And I really hope for more of the former for everyone.
As do I. The way that I like to end each of these podcasts is to just invite you to share your words of advice or encouragement or reflection to anyone who is already in the space of psychedelic assisted therapy or psychedelic healing generally, those who aspire to get involved. What would you say to those folks who are interested in supporting the healing in this space?
Don't let the naysayers get you down. If you're getting good therapeutic results, keep doing what you're doing. If you want to get better results than you're getting, talk to your neighbors who practice and get them to tell you what they're doing. It's getting them good results and incorporate that into your practice. Join ASKP. Be an advocate for your patients, not only that they get the ketamine, but they get the reimbursement they deserve and they get the compassion that they deserve for the suffering that brought them to you. And that may include time off from work. That may include some accommodations, but it includes getting in touch with their bodies and their minds and their spirits and helping them to bring them all together.
That's so beautiful. If I could add, just to stay evidence-based and to not let ego or convenience impact your treatment decisions too much. And work with a team more collaboratively. Dr. Mandel touched on that as speaking with other providers in the community, but even outside of the ketamine or psychedelic community, speak to the other providers and be in communication with them who are also caring for that patient that you're taking care of, so you can all work together towards the same goal of relieving that patient's suffering, and use a team in-house. If you want to do this more than just for a couple patients a week, and you want to do it with that level of compassion and care, it's very time intensive. And the only way to do it is to build a team around you of other clinicians and admins who share your passion and who are willing to learn about this and what it is and how it works to bring it to people with integrity.
Dr. Mandel, Sam, such a pleasure to talk to you today. I learned a lot. I feel very mind expanded in this moment personally. And as we end, I'd love for you just to share how our listeners can connect with you, can connect with the clinic. I know you've got this conference coming up in Detroit. So just by way of promo, how can we follow up on your work? How can people connect with your clinic? How can people get involved in the society? And how can people get involved in that conference?
People want to learn more about Dr. Steven Mandel or myself or the practice or treatment in general, can go to ketamineclinics.com. That's ketamineclinics.com. You can also call us Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. at 310-270-0625. We have a really wonderful team, super experienced and knowledgeable, and happy to answer any questions. And we're on social media. You can just look us up on any of your favorite socials for some fun, personalized content. Our team's like a little family, and we're always sharing, you know, fun and silly photos and personal stories, as well as interesting facts about mental health and ketamine.
We also publish a newsletter, and if you email us with a request, we'll put you on our list.
And then the conference is in September in Detroit. And what is the name of that conference?
It's in November in Detroit.
Yeah, and you can go, and that's for clinicians and members of ASKP, but you can learn more about that. It's not, I don't believe, open to the general public, but I think most people who really want to go can probably, you know, find a way, especially if they're a clinician or connected in the community, and they can go to askp.org, and there's more information on that website about the organization and the conference.
Awesome. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and the important work that you're doing. It's been a real honor to have you on the show. Thank you.
It's been an honor for me too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Eamon, thank you so much. I can't believe an hour and a half has gone by. It's incredible. We could talk to you all day, and I hope we'll have a chance to speak again soon.
Very fascinating.
Oh, I'm sure we'll talk again. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.